First of all, I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of this country, the Wurundjeri people, I've been told by my friend Natalie, and also any other elders and custodians or caretakers of this place, and introduce ourselves. So my name's Samir Gowdy, and I'm a Bundjalung woman. I come from the northern New South Wales, Queensland border ranges area, if anyone knows that country. And I also have a job where I lecture at UQ in Indigenous Health, and I work with a lot of community projects doing digital storytelling. And I'm also completing my PhD on that topic and looking at how particularly digital storytelling can be used and how it's used and why it's used and all of those kind of questions as a co-creative practice in Indigenous communities. So we're going to focus on this one particular project that I've been doing with Natalie Davey. And Natalie is the co-founder of an organisation called Pelican Expeditions and Saltwater Projects, which is an environmental project. And she's going to actually lead in and talk about that to give you the context and setting of what we've been doing. There's a lot of material within the project that we've done, and because we've got 40 minutes, we actually want to leave time for questions. So we're really going to really give you the story of this particular project without really going into a whole lot of in-depth aspects of it, and just give you some pointers so that you can have some good questions for us afterwards. And at the end, we'll also point to some websites where you'll be able to see information from the Hope Vale community, which is the community we've been working with, and a lot of history of that community. Also, Pelican has a website that has their whole history, and I also have a blog that has more the methodology and the research aspect. So you'll be able to sort of follow up with those things. And we also have a DVD that has these stories on them, and they'll all be launched in a week. We're going back to the community, and we'll be handing back the DVD and also launching the stories online on those three websites. So you'll actually be able to go and look at all of the stories at some point. And we will finish by showing you some examples. So one of the things about this project is that we very much are building. This is really the beginning of this project. We see it as a very long-term project with this community. And with the Indigenous Knowledge Centre through the State Library Queensland, that's one of our partners, Keeping Culture Strong program, which has a hub in Hope Vale where all the archival material and stories are going to be kept. And we normally would love to have brought one of the elders or one of the young people to present with us, and in the future we're hoping they're going to be the ones presenting this material. And so what we have done, and we'll put it on now, is one of the elders has sent a message in language and in English to share with you before we start this presentation. And then I'm going to hand over to Natalie to set the history of the whole project, and we'll go from there. So thanks. Oops. We did all test this before we came in and it worked perfectly. Yeah. Oh no. I
don't know whether it's worthwhile running and getting a techie person or just me starting talking.
Oh, hang on. Try it now.
Yeah.
Try it now. The system clicked itself out, I think. In fact, I think the sound's gone off completely somehow. Is this on? This is meant to be the volume here. Don't you love that? You check all your stuff.
Did you check it once when you came in?
Yeah.
It worked perfectly.
Yeah, that sound impact was gone.
So when we double clicked, should I try double clicking? It's filed. Yes, but it worked before. It was actually on there. But anyway, doesn't matter. We'll have to. I think it looks like Philomena will not be present today, which is a bit sad. So no, it won't be there. Don't worry. We'll just go back into the view show. It's very strange.
Left click.
Yeah, I did that. Yeah. La, la, la. Oh well. Sorry.
The mysteries.
Well, that's very unfortunate. That would have been one of the wonderful elders we worked with in Cape Flattery talking, Philomena Naylor, who's one of the weavers that we work with, and she... Oops. You okay? No, look, that's all right. I think we'll keep going just because time's... Yeah, thank you so much anyway. Yes, because we started late. Yes, thank you. So, anyway, that would have been Philomena Naylor and speaking in language in Gugu Mutia. And... she does a lovely introduction to what we're talking about, which is basically it's a call to people and particularly to the youth of Hope Vale to continue their traditions and value their culture. And but where I come from and where Pelican comes from, in 1990. I was part of a group of people that made a documentary about a group of six teenagers, homeless teenagers from Melbourne. And at that stage, you may remember in the media, there was a horrible heroin glut in Melbourne and a lot of kids were dying and Kennett was in power and was vilifying these kids, basically. And we thought, well, we wanted to do a story that showed their lives and their struggles and that they were real human beings with very complex and difficult backgrounds. So these very brave kids came on board with us on an old pearling lugger and we made a documentary called If It Doesn't Kill You, which was finally filmed on SBS and in a five-part series. And we took them out into the Bass Strait wilderness for about, I think it was about 3.5 weeks. And they had quite an extraordinary experience out there. And all of them, I don't know if anyone saw it on television, but for us core crew, the filmmaker was a man called Gary McKechnie. And the skipper was Peter Malcolm. And we had another friend working with us, Tim Oddy, who... is no longer with us, still a big supporter, but he's not working with us anymore. And Gary McKechnie actually, through this project, decided to become a skipper because at the end of the process, we then decided we would like to build a boat and do further projects at sea, focusing on social issues and environmental concerns. And as the idea formulated over way too much red wine that we were going to build our own boat to do. we then thought, you know, there's just so many pressing issues, and even though we're a bunch of artists, and my background is fine art, we thought, well, if we, you know, we're very interested in media and using technology and and also in marine science, and getting involved in projects that you can then use to educate the wider public in a really lively way. And actually, the filming of If It Doesn't Kill You led to really the work we're going to talk about in Hope Vale, in a way, because a young woman saw that program on SBS from Hope Vale called Coraline Bowen, and she wrote to us and said, I saw your program and I was really inspired to write to you and ask you if you could potentially come up and get involved with a youth program with our kids and taking them out to sea. And at that stage, there was a suicide. You could call it an epidemic in Hope Vale. And it was a real plea for support and help. And so we rang her back and said, we're actually building a boat. We don't know when we're going to be finished, but as soon as we're finished, we'll come up. And we would love to do work with your community. So here's another example of technology failure. I was hoping to show you the boat building process and I didn't embed it properly, but we did do a time-lapse photography of the building of the boat. It was built in Shed 19 in the Docklands, and it was the last boat building project in the Docklands before it's been taken over by developers. And unfortunately, they haven't kept a lot of the history of that area, which is fascinating, and one aspect of it was the boat building. And we were very lucky, Docklands sponsored us and they gave us the shed. It took us 5 years in the end. We
and
thought
you
it would.
Can see that on the website, that it's embedded.
Yes, I think it's still working on the website, but it's quite small. And it took us 2 years and 5 years. And during that process, we were then working out what we were going to do. We'd formed a not-for-profit company, Saltwater Projects. And we also formed a for-profit because the boat got more and more expensive and we had shareholders come in who actually don't want return, they just want the return of the projects, but they put money in to help us complete it. So it meant we had to also form another company to protect their interests in the boat. And we finally launched it in 2004 in May. And when we launched it, we looked about and we asked Andrew Denton, who's since become our patron, and which was very helpful for us in just getting started to begin with. So I just want to run through some of the projects we did. So we'd sort of put all this energy into building it and then, oh my God, now we've got to do something with this incredible vessel. And the first project we did, we formed a mission. I mean, I should cover that first, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it was to provide an inspirational focus for the involvement of people with the sea, to integrate industry, government, scientific and cultural participation in marine conservation, and to provide innovative marine education and promote a sustainable future for the world's oceans. It was interesting, as we were building as well, I mean, all the environmental issues were just... 12 years ago, it was so clear that there were big issues confronting us. And of course, the political landscape was half in sort of comatose state around it. So we were, you know, we were kind of over-idealistically trying to get that sort of on an agenda somehow. And our first bit of work was with a man who's become, he's also one of our key supporters, is Dr. Peter Gill. And we did done a few years studies of the blue whales off the Portland coast. There was a film you may have seen on ABC called The Big Blue, which was about that work. And we also, the second project we did was we sailed up to Hope Vale and we began working with the elders and youth there. And it really started as getting the youth and elders together on the boat and returning them to country, to sea country, and to country, which was Lizard Island, Jigaroo. And so that was the focus. And so that's been 5 years ago. So Samir and I just completed the fifth year. So it's been a very interesting, long kind of organic development of a project over that time. It started quite simply of just turning up with a boat, and by the fifth year now, it is it includes a massive land program and a lot more science and, of course, the digital storytelling component, which has become a very major part of what we're doing up here. So this is one of the elders and the kids having a great time on the boat. Another program we did, and we will be working further with Gabrumpa, was a coral bleaching program where we did one of the largest studies that have been done of coral bleaching in 2006. We basically surveyed the entire reef for bleaching, and we took as well on board four Indigenous trainees who trained up at the same time with the scientists. By the end of the program, they were working in total harmony with the scientists, and there was a lot of knowledge shared between the Indigenous kids and, well, they were young men really, and the scientists. And they also did a coxswain's training certificate, so they also start, and they did a full scuba course. So by the end, they were fully skilled up and collected data. And at the same time, and this is an area we're still developing, we were connecting with all the remote schools up and down the Cape, and the young men had a blog, and the idea was that they'd write about their daily experiences, what it's like to be on a boat and to do marine work or learn sailing a boat or just reflecting what was going on for them. And by the end of that, it was great, and we sort of had a school classroom as well. So and we're also doing a project down here in Melbourne called Two Bays, and we're hopefully going into our third year of that. That's basically a water quality community engagement program. It's basically doing some very good science around what's happening within the bays, doing a continual water survey, and at the same time doing community arts events and opening the boat up for people to come on board when the scientists are there. This year we're hoping to very much increase. We've had a lot of I've worked quite a lot with Carolyn Briggs to increase the Indigenous engagement and to link the traditional stories, particularly around the creation of the bay, which gives a geological history of Port Phillip and Western Port Bay, and to link that up with the current science. So it's an area that we're very interested in developing, which is basically valuing all systems of knowledge, traditional knowledge, local knowledge, and Western scientific knowledge, and putting them all together and looking where what their similarities are, not just what their differences are. It's also getting people together who manage the bay on the boat, and it's amazing how many people do not actually get out on water who manage it. You know, it's very important for them to get out and realise what it is they're managing, what are the values of these quite beautiful water systems we have that are still relatively healthy with these big city sitting on it. It's quite amazing that there's still a bit of life, and quite a lot of life. And this leads me to where we're focusing today, which is on Hope Vale and the project. And just to give you an idea, it's way up. You can't really see here. This isn't such a good map, but where that red dot is where Cape Flattery is, which is where we run the program. Hope Vale was an Aboriginal or a Lutheran mission that was formed a century and a bit ago by Pastor Schwartz. It had people from all over the Cape brought there, not just the Gugu Yimidia. But they have had a history of a lot of, as with all Aboriginal people, being moved around all the time. So a lot of the people that were there also during the Second World War were all moved either south or to Palm Island, because Pastor Schwartz was seen as being a potential. He was German, so he was put in a camp, and it meant that all the people that had variously lived there were all moved south. That was a horrendous journey as well. It just caused a lot of death. A lot of people just got cold. They weren't looked after. It's an awful story. But anyway, it is now it's a community now of about 3,000 people. And we set up every year on Cape Flattery and run various programs from the boat. Okay, I'll whiz through. From the boat and also on land, including, and Samir will talk about all those. And I'll wrap up now because I think I've been rambling on too long. And leave you with one of our young participants in the first of the pilot project, which Samir will now talk to. And this is the second year of the program too, and that's yours. Thank you.
So I do want to leave time for questions. I want to move fairly quickly. Just basically to say that Natalie and I met through projects I'd been doing on a Fulbright fellowship that I had in the United States. So I'd been working with a number of native communities doing digital storytelling with those communities, and one in particular was called the Chumash, which are in the Santa Barbara area, and they had actually had a project where they'd made a film about a story that was returning to their sea country. They'd also been moved in a similar way from their original island, which was called the Island of Lemu, which is part of the Catalina Islands, and they'd been moved onto the land of the mainland. And a few years back, they decided to rebuild their traditional canoes, which are called tommels, and make that journey home. And they've made a beautiful film called Return to Lemu, which is actually on my website. You can get the link to look at that story. So when Natalie and I made contact, which was actually through me being in America and through a mutual friend, and she invited me to come on this project, one of the things that was important, there was a link, was that we saw that there was great similarity in these two communities, and that by the work of Pelican, one of the outstanding things that I think underlies the whole relationship is this idea of returning to country and returning to sea country that generationally people have been removed from. And in fact, when Pelican first came and took the elders onto that country, many of them noted that it had been three generations since they had actually returned to that place. One of the stories which I'll show you, we're running out of time and I really want to show you the story, so we'll just have to really skip through. What I'm going to... which one is it? That down?
The right one.
So working co-creatively has been a really big thing, and I'm just going to whiz through. There's a whole list there. It'll go up on the website anyway, but co-creativity, I'd say the main points is that this... the whole project's really based on a relational project across and embedded within activities. So we don't actually show up and go, come on, sign up, you're going to do digital storytelling in the traditional form of that you're going to now tell the narrative and make a story. We really show up with the equipment, this is what we did this year, and we are there. And through the duration of a whole range of activities, people come and use that space in different ways, whether it's showing movies at night, borrowing cameras, learning how to use a computer, learning how to use Audacity and GarageBand. We had, you know, Zoom and an Edirol there in terms of equipment for people who are interested. And we were using six PCs that all had Photo Story 3 and Movie Maker. And we had a printer and a scanner and we had a generator. So to get this stuff there, it's like a very long journey on a barge to actually get it to the site. There's no road. You drive in over 4 hours of sand dunes at low tide to get there, and it's 40 degrees heat and there's crocodiles and taipans. So it's you know, it's a feat. It's actually a logistical feat. So during this time, just to give you, in that 3 weeks, we had workshops and we were just present, basically, and allowed people to unfold naturally into what they wanted to do and how they wanted to do it. So very little directive, but just us accompanying people and saying, how about this, how about that, would you like to make music now, would you like to put some words to that, gee, you could make a story. So just following that process. So these are some of the examples of how that's happening. And then basically within what Pelican was doing offshore with seagrass mapping and turtle and dugong research and returning to country, the young people then became engaged in recording or photography or, you know, developing their stories further in this setting. The other thing that was very important about this was that it generated an interest between the elders and young people that I feel in my findings, as I've done interviews, one of the things that really showed up is a sense of crossing over the generational divide around old ways and traditional ways of doing things, and that this is a way to enable engagement in a different way. And it also begs the question of when things become take people away from the performance of traditional culture, or where they actually allow another medium to engage with traditional culture. And I think that's a very interesting question. So these are some of the activities that then formed the guts of the stories that were told. We had dancing, traditional weaving, a kayak journey back to country, which is the first time in 150 years that the Barma of the Yunichir have returned to that country under their own steam, basically, hunting and fishing and gathering. So what we ended up with was we had, in that 3 weeks, 83 people who came through that tent and undertook some sort of training. We had 9,000 images that have now been archived within the community, and 18 fully finished digital stories made by people as young as 6 to the age of 88. So in terms of what we ended up with, we really ended up with what I would describe some different styles. One is the literacy style that we saw really strongly being developed in the younger age group, and they became very interested in how do we spell, how do we say, how do we say it in language, how do we say it in English. We had kids at the age of 7 who didn't want to leave the tent. We were going, can we go and have lunch now? Yeah. We want to finish our story, and sat there for 5 hours straight. So totally engaged. We had another, what I would call style, that's more, if you look at the history of digital storytelling and how a lot of digital stories are done, we've really adapted it, and it was much more than just digital storytelling in terms of what we did. But we did have some stories that we would say are classic narrative style of people's life stories. And then the other style that we saw developing was what we would call an educational and archival process, that was really, a lot of that was linking the scientific and traditional owners' knowledge together in the same format, so we can use it in the curriculum. The other style I would call a documentary oral history, or a pictorial style that was really actively documenting actual events that were happening either by the young people or the old people. And then the other thing is using it as an evaluation tool and a reporting mechanism. So there's all of those sort of aspects. So I'm talking very quickly, and we've still got 10 minutes, which is great, so we can show you a couple of examples. But if you want more information, and these websites that are there, hope that stays there now, we're going to be launching the stories onto all three of those websites, but as I said, they all have different components of this bigger picture of the story. Mine's really focusing on the research aspect and digital storytelling and film. Pelican's really the whole story of Pelican, and then Hopevale Wiki really has the community archives, audio, radio interviews with ABC that did interviews with us during the journey, etc. So,
do you want me to go on to the story?
I think we just go on. So we're going to show three examples from this DVD. The first one's a very quick one. It's 50 seconds. It was made by the youngest participant. Yeah. He'd never held a camera. He'd actually never been on a computer, and he was 6.5 years of age, and so this is his little piece that he did over a couple of days. So he's done the whole thing.
Coming thing by the sea, with my friends at family, laughing, talking around the fire, and we're going higher. We've been dancing, having fun on the sand and in the sun. The sun is deep, the fire is bright every night.
I just realised that. But it would catch it. I was just here.
This, we also screened these stories to the whole community on the beach. So we had 150 people. Some of them hadn't seen what the kids were doing. You know, some of them hadn't seen what had happened on Pelican and what the other stories were. And what was remarkable was that all the little kids sat at the front and they were reading each other's stories as they were
reading them out loud.
And the teachers were there and they were saying, this is fantastic.
This is amazing.
Now we can really bring this into the classroom and it has relevance to their lives. The other thing was that with some of the other stories that the elders were saying, I didn't know the kids could do that. Mm. You know, so there was that aspect of a lot of pride and self-esteem. And for the older people, some of their stories, which the kayak is one of them, and those young people that undertook that journey, which was a very initiating kind of journey to go back to country in that way and had a lot of significance, and I'll let the story tell that. But what I will say is it generated a whole also interest in the community about how did we go to Lizard before? What was it called in language? What are the stories of that place? Where is the archival footage, which John Haviland in the 70s is one of the only anthropologists who's really got a complete Gugu Yimmatur history in language that hasn't ever been archived, and he's actually coming next year to start that process with the community. So there's been a lot of flow on. The next one we'll show is more in that traditional DST format. This was done by a young man who was there part of the AFL Development Life Promotions Program. He'd spoken to both of us over a couple of days about his life story, and literally came to the tent with the four-wheel drive running outside.
We had 3 minutes, three-minute take, and this is it.
And I stuck, we took photos with him. He had some photos he'd taken, and then I literally said to him, you've got 2 minutes to talk.
Yeah.
And we'd talked enough in the previous
days. He was amazing.
Say, start like this, cover this, do this. And he literally talked in one take in 2 minutes. Got in the car and drove off. So,
and then trusted us as well.
And trusted us to then pretty much complete it for him. So this is his story.
My name is Jarara Murray Japamos. Jarara Stand, it's an Aboriginal word for rock with water flowing over it. I was born in Melbourne. My father's family are from Yorta Yorta. Your tribe, my mum's family is Wiradjuri. My story is a bit of a sad one, but at the same time pretty happy, I reckon. When I was younger, I lost my brother to a heroin overdose, and about 8 months later, my sister, Marianne, her drink was spiked at a party and she passed away. They were both in their early 20s. When I finished school, I moved to Brisbane and I started working down there. I was a bit depressed being in Brisbane away from all my family. We were in Cairns, and I got myself involved into some drugs, ecstasy, cocaine, marijuana, and started drinking a lot. But I decided one day that it wasn't doing any good for me and I didn't feel very well. So I walked away from the people that I was hanging around, that were my so-called friends, but they weren't. When I was younger and I was growing up, I used to be scared of chickens. My uncle, I always used to look up to him. He used to tell me, before I go to sleep at night and stuff, he used to say, Jajuwaden, which means I am strong. And, he used to tell me to say this word all the time, so when I got old enough, I ended up getting it tattooed on my arm. After leaving Brisbane about 2 months ago, I moved back to Cairns and I got a job with AFL Cape York, and it's been great. I've been travelling around to all the communities and seeing all the kids and working with them. I've been really happy now, so I don't even think about drugs or being depressed or anything. I'm a lot happier now, and I'd have to say, if I could say anything to any kids, just be strong, and if anyone's going to say anything negative about you, just walk past it and move on, because they only be negative because they're jealous of what you've got, and you just got to stand up and be strong. So that's your way.
We might have to fly into the...
I think we will. It means we've really cut out our question time, really, but I think we'll just show this last one.
So this is from the more documentary style and also returning to country oral history.
The face of the alarm. It would be very scary. The big wide ocean, what secret do you hold? Are there monsters in your world? We know you shot the crocodiles, sharks, huge waves, can turn into a monster. I will defy you. I will paddle the kayak over the ocean blue. From Tuam, Rocky Island, north direction. Yes, as I crawled on the kayak, I looked out to sea. From the shelter of the island, I could see the blue ocean showing their white teeth as it smiled back at me, saying, "Are you scared? Come on, I defy you." Oh, the feeling of victory as I paddled my kayak on the deep blue sea, kept smiling and showing his teeth. I could hear the waves saying, "Come." Its white capsule as it touched me and sent me on my way. Even the seabed cheering me on. I would feel the river cheering me on.
Mm-hmm. now.
Setting up. Does anyone have any questions very quickly we could answer, and otherwise we'll just be quiet and let these guys go on, I think. So anybody
don't create an awkward silence.
No, okay.
For us to start with.
Yeah. I just realised this is meant to be podcasting and I haven't had it on the whole time. I should also mention that Yeah, we had a lot of partners in this process and a lot of in-kind support as well. And the partners were Arts Queensland financially, which helped us with obviously the logistics of getting all the equipment in and the paying of wages to a couple of the other digital trainers. We had four digital storytelling trainers. And the other partnership was with the State Library Queensland. And also I had support of what's called in-kind support from the CRCAH, which is the Cooperative Research Centre of Aboriginal Health, for my research aspect and the development actually of the DVD and returning of materials to the community. So to answer that question, that was a very important partnership. I met with Leah Guise-Peters, who's the head of the State Library Queensland, and proposed to her that they become involved as a partner with Pelican Expeditions and Hope Vale and with the research component. And so the Indigenous Knowledge Centres are hubs that are throughout Queensland and actually throughout Australia, I think, except for Western Australia. And they're excellent. I would really recommend people doing this kind of work really think about the sustainability of their projects in community and how to archive that for future generations, which is extremely important for Aboriginal communities. The highlight of it is that it's actually housed within the community in their ITKC, which is the Indigenous Technology Centre, through the Keeping Strong, Keeping Cultures Strong program. So all of those 9,000 images, all of those 18 stories are now archived within that format and also linked to the websites. So, yeah. Maybe one more? Yep. Okay, so the trainers basically was myself, and Natalie had worked in a pilot with me the first year when she invited me to come up, and so we basically worked on the design and the overall sort of getting the funding and the partners, etc. James Leach, who works for the State Library Queensland, was sort of loaned to us, given to us, or whatever, for the first week of it. So he came in actually with the equipment, which was the other in-kind that the State Library provided. So we had the laptops and the generators and the printers and scanners and projectors and screens barged into that area or taken, as I said, over sand dunes and low tide, etc. And then I also employed a woman who I'd done a number of projects with in northern New South Wales with the Bunjalung people that I've, that's my community, but with Cabbage Tree and Bunjum and some of the communities there. And we'd previously worked together with youth projects with homelessness and other projects over a long period of time. So, yeah, I think we're ready. Excellent. And thank you.